Section C. We now consider whether the DTA allows the Court of Appeals to conduct a proceeding meeting these standards. We are obligated to construe the statute to avoid constitutional problems if it is fairly possible to do so. There are limits to this principle, however. The canon of constitutional avoidance does not supplant traditional modes of statutory interpretation. We cannot ignore the text and purpose of a statute in order to save it. The DTA does not explicitly empower the Court of Appeals to order the applicant in the DTA review proceeding released should the court find that the standards and procedures used at his CSRT hearing were insufficient to justify detention. This is troubling. Yet for present purposes, we can assume congressional silence permits a constitutionally required remedy. In that case, it would be possible to hold that a remedy of release is impliedly provided for. The DTA might be read, furthermore, to allow the petitioners to assert most, if not all, of the legal claims they seek to advance, including their most basic claim, that the president has no authority under the AUMF to detain them indefinitely. Whether the president has such authority turns on whether the AUMF authorizes and the Constitution permits. The indefinite detention of enemy combatants, as the Department of Defense defines that term. Thus, a challenge to the president's authority to detain is in essence a challenge to the department's definition of enemy combatant, a standard used by the CSRTs in petitioners' cases. At oral argument, the Solicitor General urged us to adopt both these constructions if doing so would allow MCA Section 7 to remain intact. The absence of a release remedy and specific language allowing AUMF challenges are not the only constitutional infirmities from which the statute potentially suffers, however. The more difficult question is whether the DTA permits the Court of Appeals to make requisite findings of fact. The DTA enables petitioners to request review of their CSRT determination by the Court of Appeals, but the scope of review provision confines the Court of Appeals' role to reviewing whether the CSRT followed the standards and procedures issued by the Department of Defense and assessing whether those standards and procedures are lawful. Among these standards is the requirement that the conclusion of the tribunal be supported by a preponderance of the evidence, allowing a rebuttable presumption in favor of the government's evidence. Assuming the DTA can be construed to allow the Court of Appeals to review or correct the CSRT's factual determinations, as opposed to merely certifying that the tribunal applied the correct standard of proof, we see no way to construe the statute to allow what is also constitutionally required in this context, an opportunity for the detainee to present relevant exculpatory evidence that was not made part of the record in the earlier proceedings. On its face, the statute allows the Court of Appeals to consider no evidence outside the CSRT record. In the parallel litigation, however, the Court of Appeals determined that the DTA allows it to order the production of all reasonably available information in the possession of the U.S. government bearing on the issue of whether the detainee meets the criteria to be designated as an enemy combatant, regardless whether this evidence was put before the CSRT. The government, with support from five members of the Court of Appeals, disagrees with this interpretation. For present purposes, however, we can assume that the Court of Appeals was correct, that the DTA allows introduction and consideration of relevant exculpatory evidence that was reasonably available to the government at the time of the CSRT, but not made part of the record. Even so, the DTA review proceeding falls short of being a constitutionally adequate substitute, for the detainee still would have no opportunity to prevent evidence discovered after the CSRT proceedings concluded. Under the DTA, the Court of Appeals has the power to review CSRT determinations by assessing the legality of standards and procedures. This implies the power to inquire into what happened at the CSRT hearing and perhaps to remedy certain deficiencies in that proceeding. But should the Court of Appeals determine that the CSRT followed appropriate and lawful standards and procedures, it will have reached the limits of its jurisdiction. There is no language in the DTA that can be construed to allow the Court of Appeals to admit and consider newly discovered evidence that could not have been made part of the CSRT record because it was unavailable to to either the government or the detainee when the CSRT made its findings. This evidence, however, may be critical to the detainee's argument that he is not an enemy combatant and there is no cause to detain him. This is not a remote hypothetical. One of the petitioners, Mohammed Nekla, requested at his CSRT hearing that the government contact his employer. The petitioner claimed the employer would corroborate Nekla's contention that he had no affiliation with Al-Qaeda. Although the CSRT determined this testimony would be relevant, it also found the witness was not reasonably available to testify at the time of the hearing. Petitioner's counsel, however, now represents the witness is available to be heard. If a detainee can present reasonably available evidence demonstrating there is no basis for his continued detention, he must have the opportunity to present this evidence to a habeas corpus court. Even under the Court of Appeals' generous construction of the DTA, however, the evidence identified by Nekla would be inadmissible in a DTA review proceeding. The role of an Article III court in the exercise of its habeas corpus function cannot be circumscribed in this manner. By foreclosing consideration of evidence not presented or reasonably available to the detainee at the CSRT proceedings, the DTA disadvantages the detainee by limiting the scope of collateral review to a record that may not be accurate or complete. In other contexts, e.g., in post-trial habeas cases where the prisoner already has had a full and fair opportunity to develop a factual predicate of his claims, similar limitations on the scope of habeas review may be appropriate. In this context, however, where the underlying detention proceedings lack the necessary adversarial character, the detainee cannot be held responsible for all deficiencies in the record. The government does not make the alternative argument that the DTA allows for the introduction of previously unavailable exculpatory evidence on appeal. It does point out, however, that if a detainee obtains such evidence, he can request that the Deputy Secretary of Defense convene a new CSRT. Whatever the merits of this procedure, it is an insufficient replacement for the factual review these detainees are entitled to receive through habeas corpus. The Deputy Secretary's determination whether to initiate new proceedings is a wholly discretionary one, and we see no way to construe the DTA to allow a detainee to challenge the Deputy Secretary's decision not to open a new CSRT pursuant to Instruction 5421.1. Congress directed the Secretary of Defense to devise procedures for considering new evidence. But the detainee has no mechanism for ensuring that those procedures are followed. DTA Section 1005E2C makes clear that the Court of Appeals' jurisdiction is limited to consideration of whether the status determination of the Combatant Status Review Tribunal with regard to such alien was consistent with the standards and procedures specified by the Secretary of Defense, and whether the use of such standards and procedures to make the determination is consistent with the Constitution and laws of the United States. DTA Section 1005E2A further narrows the Court of Appeals' jurisdiction to reviewing any final decision of a combatant status review tribunal that an alien is properly detained as an enemy combatant. The Deputy Secretary's determination whether to convene a new CSRT is not a status determination of the combatant status review tribunal, much less a final decision of that body. We do not imply DTA review would be a constitutionally sufficient replacement for habeas corpus, but for these limitations on the detainee's ability to present exculpatory evidence. For even if it were possible, as a textual matter, to read into the statute each of the necessary procedures we have identified, we could not overlook the cumulative effect of our doing so. To hold that the detainees at Guantanamo may, under the DTA, challenge the President's legal authority to detain them, contest the CSRT's findings of fact, supplement the record on review with exculpatory evidence, and request an order of release would come close to reinstating the Section 2241 habeas corpus process Congress sought to deny them. The language of the statute, read in light of Congress's reasons for enacting it, cannot bear this interpretation. Petitioners have met their burden of establishing that the DTA review process is on its face an inadequate substitute for habeas corpus. Although we do not hold that an adequate substitute must duplicate Section 2241 in all respects, it suffices that the government has not established that the detainee's access to the statutory review provisions at issue is an adequate substitute for the writ of habeas corpus. MCA Section 7 thus effects an unconstitutional suspension of the writ. In view of our holding, we need not discuss the reach of the writ with respect to claims of unlawful conditions of treatment or confinement.